Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about what's happening in the world today. We talk about where we think the world is going, and we talk about the future. And we take a pretty unusual view of the future. We believe that the world might just be getting better all the time. We believe that if you're not excited about the future, maybe you're not paying attention. And we believe that something is going to happen. Something wonderful. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Very, very good.
This is a special occasion for us because I don't think we've ever done a Thursday evening before.
That's right. I think we're trying out every night of the week and deciding just which one works best for us, or maybe more accurately, we do it when we can.
Well, we do it when we can. Let's think about this. We've done lots of Sundays. We've done Mondays. We did that one Saturday. I did a Friday show. Now we've done a Thursday show. What's left?
Well, there was one Tuesday show, if I'm not mistaken. What we got left is Wednesday now.
If we hit a Wednesday, then we will have had this show on every night of the week, and you know we should explore the Nielsen ratings for each and see what's the best fit. You know, go through all that pile of the demographic data that I'm sure they give you from Blog Talk Radio. Well, we've also got back from the inauguration our chat host Michael Darling. Hello, Michael.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Well, you were live in D.C., weren't you?
I was live in D.C., and I don't really have 2 million new friends. It just feels like it.
or if not friends, 2 million people you've actually had physical contact with over that period of time, right?
Yeah, and I was counting the number of people that I had physical contact with, because in all instances except for handshaking and one hug, it was undesired. And it occurs to me that aside from there comes a point in every crowd where you sort of lose control of your personal space and you just have to go with the flow. I get that. But sitting on trains and planes and automobiles and even being in restaurants or other places where, yeah, okay, it can get crowded and there's people, Americans somehow have lost we don't have the civilization gene that deals with crowds, and people are just crashing into you all the time. It's like, seriously? I mean, we're in an airplane. The row behind me, the back of my seat is the front of your row. I get that. But just because you got to stand up doesn't mean you got to grab my seat and shake the three people in our row. Anyway, I've vented. I'm done. It was a good time, and I had a blast.
Oh, gosh. Well, we can always hope for change in that way, huh?
That's right. That's the plan.
Hope and change.
Hope and
change.
Speaking
of which, that's what we're that's what we're all about tonight. We're going to be setting the agenda for the future, the Speculist way. And to help us out with that, we have a special surprise guest, our best pal on Fast Forward Radio, our most frequent guest, and just one of the most beloved figures in all of the Speculist universe, I would have to say, our friend, futurist and writer, PJ Manning. Hello, PJ.
Hello, gentlemen, and now I'm blushing.
Well,
thank you. That was
one
of the sweetest things I've ever heard. Thank you so much.
Well, just a pleasure as always having you on the show, and especially on such short notice. We were just throwing together our notes here, and Stephen said, "Hey, you know what? PJ would be a great person to have on to talk about this stuff." And sure enough, on very little notice, made yourself available. So thank you for being with us as we work
thank
through
you
these
for,
issues this evening.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, I understand you're dealing with a little recovering from a little head virus, cold kind of thing going on, so we're not going to tax you too hard this evening.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've definitely had some genetic code messing with my genetic code, and not making me very happy about it. So, yeah, I'm on the mend, though, which is good.
Well, glad to hear that, and you sound great. So hopefully we'll have something in the list here. Actually, I think I don't know.
The very first thing. The very first thing.
Yeah. We'll probably get a sense of it. So why don't we, I don't know, Stephen, you want to take the first one or you want me to take it?
Well, we can kind of launch straight into it. One of the things we're hoping for in the future is the end of aging and other diseases, head colds included. That's the first thing.
I'm looking forward to that.
As are we all.
And when we say end of aging, go ahead.
No, I was going to say the end of aging is. I'd like a definition of that, gentlemen, please.
The end of aging. I suppose what you would say is not aging will always be with us, but to be able to repair the damage caused by aging on a periodic basis and basically reset our biological age when every so often. I think that's the ultimate goal.
Yeah, the end of. Obviously, people will continue to get older. What we're looking for, we think about guests we've had on the program to talk about this. We had Aubrey de Grey on a while back, and we've talked about healthy life extension and how nanotechnology and biotechnology can all contribute to expanding and extending healthy lifespan. The end of aging means, for me, eliminating that damage, eliminating that destruction of the human organism that occurs as years goes by, that accumulated damage that ultimately results in death. I mean, if nothing else kills you, it's always aging that gets to you in the end. So we're talking about putting the necessary technology in place or the necessary what would it be, biological fixes to the human condition that would make it possible for us not to suffer that destruction. And the interesting thing is when you talk to someone like Aubrey de Grey, read his book, or some of the other folks that we've had on the program, if you look into this this field of healthy life extension, it's actually a much simpler, much smaller, much more controllable set of problems than you would initially think that need to be solved to get us there. Aubrey has it down to how many items is it, Stephen? It's
seven.
Yeah. Seven different problems that he talks about needing to be solved in order to achieve what he calls his strategies for engineered negligible senescence. And if you can figure out how to solve these problems, not to say that they're easy problems, right? Not to say that they're no-brainers by any stretch of the imagination. These are difficult, challenging problems. But if and when, and he talks about how we can address these things, then we've taken most of the steps we need to eliminate this ultimately debilitating, I think humiliating and destructive life-ending process that we call aging. So that's what we're looking for there. Now, what about other diseases? What hope, Stephen, do you think we have along those lines? What can we do about PJ's cold?
Well, we're getting better and better at being able to sequence diseases, sequence the DNA of diseases, and then hopefully at some point we'll be able to, quickly address each of these colds and flus that come along, quickly. I guess one thing you always want to do if you're, is to come up with something that about a virus or a bacterial infection or something that makes it different from the cells in your body and attack it on that basis. Because if you're just throwing out toxins or something, obviously you can hurt your own cells, your own cells of your body. So you find out how these organisms are different from our own bodies and attack it on that basis, find its weak link.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think about when we get into talking about nanotech a little bit, we talk about these, molecularly precise machines that will be able to enhance our own immune systems tremendously. making us much more disease resistant. Then we've had guests on the program like Dr. James Flea, who's talked about using human immunity as it exists currently amongst those who have it in a more precise way, in a more directed way at certain diseases like cancer, that you could actually take that potentially take that cancer fighting ability that some people have and transfer it to other people. So there are a lot of different potential technologies and approaches that are currently being explored to help us get rid of diseases. And one of the things
that's interesting. I think a lot of people are completely unaware that the human immune system can fight cancer at all, but it can. You know, so that's to me that's the fact that it can is very interesting, isn't it?
Well, is it certain immune systems, because one of the things that I was briefly involved with was when Chris Heward and his family were investigating before he died, the possibility of transferring genetic material from people who have a genetic propensity to fight cancer.
Right.
And that's what I found that fascinating, that they felt that was a possibility.
Well,
I filled out the form and everything.
What they're talking about with
Dr. Critch, it was too late.
With Dr. Shui, he's actually talking about something as simple as a blood transfusion from people who have have the ability to fight cancer, and some aspect of their blood can be done. So I'm getting a message from Michael Darling that we're not that he's having trouble
we're
with
back.
Audio. We're back.
Yeah,
okay.
I went dead silent for 10 seconds, and I don't know why. And apparently, I'm the only one that had that problem, so it's me.
Okay.
Well, my Skype had dropped, but I called back in, so that maybe that was the problem. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Well.
Anyway, PJ.
Phil, you were on top of of the method that Dr. Shui was talking about, probably better than all of us. If you could kind of explain it.
Yeah. Well, in fact, his methodology is exactly what PJ was describing. And in fact, PJ, the team that was working with Chris Heward had Dr. Shui in to consult with them at one point.
Ah. Okay.
Yeah, I was part of that Facebook group that was. Friends of Chris, and one of the things I did at one point was I said, hey, you know, we talked to this guy, maybe he would be of some benefit to you, and it came back actually Dr. Sui was one of the people we talked to and one of the sets of ideas that we looked at. So I'm glad that those connections are being made. It's too bad that obviously it's a very sad. I hadn't heard that Chris had died, so I'm very sad to hear that. That Dr. Sui's work and that this research isn't far enough along to save everyone or to save a particular person, but it's a very encouraging field that he is pursuing. The idea of taking the I believe they're called is it granulocytes from the human immune system from people who seem to be particularly resistant to cancer, and putting those, sharing that with people who don't have that same level of immunity. And this research, I don't know, Stephen, while I was out, if you guys got into how Dr. Sui originally established this line of research.
Well, no, we really didn't get into that. It's fascinating stuff, though. Even the season of the year is important to this.
Absolutely. Well, he had worked it out to the age and the time of the year, and all these could be tremendous factors in terms of for the human trial, how you would get the highest chance of getting cancer fighting material to transfuse into someone else. But he had actually started by discovering a mouse that he could not give cancer to. This was his research began with mice. And he discovered a strain of mice that no matter what you did, you couldn't give them cancer. They had a natural immunity to cancer. And the speculation became, well, if you can have that with one species, why can't you have that with another species? And that's what set him out looking for, if not 100% cancer-proof humans, then highly cancer-resistant humans. And I think that I think that we'll be seeing a lot more interesting and very positive results from that kind of research. One of the things that I want to see happen with some of these really kind of chronic, complex, hard to fight diseases that people deal with is we'll deal with them in stages and we'll get them to, you know, a more manageable level. And this is something that when we did our predictions with the Meanbox folks a couple weeks ago, one of mine was, I've talked about this before, is, you know, maybe we don't see cancer wiped out in the next 10 years, the next 20 years, but maybe we see cancer taken to the level that, say, diabetes is right now, or some other disease that people are able to manage and able to live with. And I think we'll see that for heart disease. I think we'll see that for a lot of things that currently are probably more serious. And then a few years ago, you think about a few years ago, or a couple decades ago, there were a lot of different forms of cancer that were just automatically a death sentence. And you hear about people surviving them, going on with their lives, and you know, living for quite a few years longer. I think we'll see an increasing amount of that leading to a time when cancer becomes something like diabetes. It becomes something that people manage, something they deal with, and then ultimately, you know, down the road, we'll see the time when we actually eliminate that one. Well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're setting the agenda for the future, talking about how we get to the future we want. And we've got an online chat going on that topic. If you're interested in joining us, join us in the online chat. If you're listening live, if you're listening to us by recording, please leave your comments at speculist.com. So what's our next item on the list?
New production technologies and the end of poverty and hunger.
Wow. Now, we talked about this one a little bit on last week's show, I think.
Yeah.
And, of course, this has to do with if we're going to end poverty and hunger, you know, what are the things that we have to put in place to make that happen? Well, there's one school of thought that says the real end to poverty and hunger is going to require a political solution. That there's probably already enough material stuff in the world to support the world's population. It's just a matter of creating the right infrastructure such that everyone has the ability to get what they need. What do you think of that argument, Stephen?
Well, that was my argument, I believe, Phil. I was probably the one that brought that up. That, you know, when it comes to many of the places that suffer from periodic hunger and things like that, often the aid that is sent over to those countries is intercepted by the powers that be in those countries, and it's, you know, and passed out to, you know, those who are politically, you know, tied to those in power, and so that's unfortunate. But so that politics would be a part of the hunger problem. But you know, obviously, technologies that would allow us to grow crops in places that we can't grow crops now is part of what we're thinking about, and even things like vat meat that would allow us to produce meat without the incredible inefficiencies associated with raising animals.
Well, for anyone who wasn't listening closely, that was vat with a V, not bat meat. That Stephen is suggesting that we eat that. meat grown in vats from genetically it's like a cloned self-growing meat rather than killing an animal to get to it, and you get a big environmental benefit from that as well. Well, I think that let me throw this one over to PJ. PJ, do we need technology to end poverty and hunger, or do we just need do we need a different approach to organizing humanity?
Sadly, I think the issue with the political solution is that if there is a scarcity mindset, the political solution will never be achieved. Politics is based on scarcity.
Mm.
It's
right.
Based on who will I elect, who will I put in power who will get me what I need. And in many cases, and you see this all the time in the wars in Africa, get me what I need at any price. And that's, you know, once it's the scarcity mindset that creates political tensions, et cetera. So really it has to be an end to scarcity. And the only way we can have an end to scarcity is truly through a technological solution. Until people can see, wow, I have in my little nanofabber, you know, everything I need to make me warm and well-fed and comfortable, then that sense of I will elect people who will get me anything I need at any price diminishes.
See, I think there's a strong argument to be made that that's the case, that it's to a certain extent it's a social and political change that has to be enabled by the technology. It reminds me of years ago when I was just a very young fellow, must have been just very young because this would have been like in the 80s, so I don't know, when I was like, you know, 10 or 11, I guess. But I was working for a software company called Quark, maker of Quark Express desktop publishing software. And we did this whole ad campaign. And this is just, you have to remember how big desktop publishing was at one point, how new of an idea that was, and how exciting that was, that this idea that I don't actually, I can have like a typeset page, right, and I can like print out a book if I want to without having to go to a lithographer, without having to go through all that overhead and all that infrastructure. It was like this great deindustrialization of publishing that was occurring, and we were riding this wave of how this was, you know, we're not just selling you this software that allows you to do this. We're part of this social revolution because, and this was an old quote, this was not something that was invented in the age of desktop publishing, but it was something we rode with in a big way. And it was the slogan in our advertising campaign was, the freedom of the press belongs to those who own one. And I think that there's a very similar idea in what you're suggesting, PJ, which is that, you know, the freedom to live your own life, the freedom to produce, belongs to those who own the, you know, control the means of producing what they need to get by in their own lives.
But what I think is fascinating is the example that you used, because there's some very interesting potential parallels to what you described. I mean, look at desktop publishing. Here was a situation where I remember that period of time. Everybody thought, I'm going to be able to publish off my computer. Oh, my God. You know, hallelujah. We'll never need to buy a book again.
Yeah.
And what and look at it now. I mean, people are buying more books. Ironically, even though publishing is suffering, it's only suffering for the same reason that television is suffering and movies are suffering. There's so much product out there. People are actually buying more books than ever. And they're not buying them via their own desktop. They're buying them through Amazon or wherever. The problem with publishers is there are now so many publishers and so many books that their market share is decreasing. But so what happened there? It was the same thing with the paperless office. I've got more paper now than I ever had. I think the issue with something like publishing is that people didn't think that the price of entry was ultimate and the hours needed to create that product was worth the bother to buy the machinery to make it all look slick, to, you know, just the paper. I don't know about you, but, you know, Staples, I should just have a direct intravenous line from my arm to Staples.
But it's true. The desktop infrastructure is great for, you know, if you need to put something up on the bulletin board, right? Or if you want to do a report that you're going to hand out to your coworkers or something like that. But yeah, if you want to write a book, you know, it doesn't replace that. I don't know of anybody who goes online to what is the site that has all the public domain books on it?
Project Gutenberg.
Gutenberg, and like downloads those and prints those out on their laser printer and reads it. I mean, I suppose they could.
No, but instead what they do is they put it on their e-book or their Kindle or whatever else. I mean, there is that. I mean, the irony is that in a funny way, technology leapfrogged right over the quark and went straight to, well, just stick it. Why print it at all? You know, if you don't have to print
right.
it, just stick the damn thing on your computer. And then, of course, you know, I don't know about you, but when I have to print something, a lot of copies of something big, I'd rather give it to Kinko's, because the hours that I would spend doing that myself, I'd rather pay some guy to have it all nicely collated with the covers I've picked out. And you know, it's fascinating. So it's what is it? What are the things that people want to have control over and need to have control over? You know, food is one of those things. Food is one of those things that, you know, I would like my food my way. I'd like my food to be organic and clean and healthy, et cetera. Now, if I could create that food myself without having the hours to have a farm and a garden, et cetera, and I could actually do other things and still have that food and create it myself, then that would be something.
Just going back to the publishing thing again, I'm reading a biography of Charles Dickens, and at the height of his popularity, 25% of Britain read his works.
Wow.
And like 10% of the English speaking world. You know, as a matter of a percentage of English speaking readers, I don't think that's been surpassed. It we become more diluted, and even the most popular authors are happy if, you know, if they can get just a fraction of that.
The only person who beat Dickens was a single book, not including the Bible, a single book, Harry Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin.
That was
the only book. Yeah, that's the only book, the most read book of the 19th century internationally, because it wasn't just read by Americans. It was, interestingly, read by many people overseas. In fact, if you remember the story Anna and the King of Siam, or The King and I, the musical The King and I,
sure.
It's actually about Uncle Tom's Cabin being read in Siam, Thailand, and how upset the royal family got, particularly the king, by the fact that here was a book, it was anti-slavery, and he had a very successful slave nation, kingdom, and run on slavery. So it was actually read all over the world. And there's a real reason that doesn't exist anymore. And again, it's about market share. We have so much more media now. It's impossible, and we have this niching of media that makes it equally impossible to even find out about things unless you're getting that information through certain outlets. So, you know, it's why the conservative base will read Left Behind, and the liberal base will read, you know, the Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. There's
and everybody reads Harry Potter, according to Michael Darling. So.
My kids sure do.
That's interesting how the individualization killed the universality of authorship. So Dickens kind of reigned supreme, except for Harry Beecher Stowe. I was really scared there when you came in on that, PJ, as to what you were going to say. It's like, oh, well, Dickens had it, but there was one book that came in and killed it all. I was afraid you were going to say something like, you know, Jonathan Livingston Seagull or something. Like that. Love story,
no, but,
right? It's like, oh, no. But
Harry
obviously, Uncle Tom's Cabin is.
Well, Harry Beecher Stowe, actually, in the United States, it was read by almost every single man, woman, and child in the country. I forget the publishing statistics, but it was something like there was like one for every household in the United States, which
wow.
is, I mean, just that's mind-boggling. And in fact, when Abraham Lincoln met her, he said, "So you're the little lady who created this great big war."
Yeah, amazing.
That's how influential it was.
You know, swinging it back just for a moment to the to the publishing analogy, that PJ, as you were talking earlier about how we don't necessarily bother with doing everything with that technology. The other side of that caught my attention was, and it hasn't hurt the market at all, right? The idea that books would be hurt by that. Turns out it's not true. Books aren't hurt by that. They're not hurt by the fact that we can download them on the internet if we want to, that we can read whole books online. If you still walk into a Barnes & Noble or to your local independent bookseller, there's going to be crowds of people, and people buy books, and they own more books than they ever have. And Stephen, I think about what that says to one of the things that we've talked about a number of times when this subject of nanofab technology, replication technology comes up, is that you know, how it's going to destroy the whole value chain. It's going to destroy the whole retail business, that Walmart and auto parts stores and everyone else will be opposing this big time, because this technology will put them out of business. And I wonder, having looked at that analogy to desktop publishing, if that's even true. Maybe happens is around the world you have people enabled to make their own stuff, to make, as PJ said, their own food, but because they're then kind of raised out of poverty, they suddenly become big-time consumers, and they buy even more pre-made stuff than they would have before.
But yeah. I think it's actually – I'm sorry. I was going to say, I think it's actually more different than that. I think the point is that there are people who can create stuff, and there are people who will consume it. Not every consumer is a creator. In fact, 99% of consumers are not creators. So you still have to, in one way or another, buy that entertainment, however you're going to be entertained through any creative form, from somebody who knows how to entertain.
Right. Or cook, or whatever is being, whatever service is being provided.
Well, you know, I'm a pretty crappy cook, but I can feed myself. But you know, I can't make my own music.
Yeah.
Right.
But you enjoy music.
I love music,
consume,
and I love
consume music from
I consume music. Exactly,
yeah.
Right. Exactly right. So I think the difference is simply that the technology is just the mode of distribution. You're still moving product from creator through distributor to consumer. The issue becomes, how do you do that? Now, if I could download through my nanofab or through whatever, you know, the next great novel, that's great. I still have to pay whoever wrote the novel for that novel.
Right.
And there, that's what I mean by, you know, there's a difference in consumables between books and food. And I think anybody who can crack the self-manufacture of necessities, you know, it's the old joke that there's certain things, even in an economic downturn, that everybody needs. Everybody still needs toilet paper. Everybody
right.
still wants to, you know, every so often drink a Coke. I hear spam actually has gone up unbelievably. Have you heard that? I don't mean computer spam. I mean the meat spam the stock price for Hormel or whoever it is that makes spam has raised dramatically.
See, so it's not all economic bad news, huh?
Right. But I mean, what I'm saying is that there are, you know, there's still things that people need,
right.
and
yeah, people,
you know,
anticipating
I live with that.
They stock up on spam, right? They load the basement
right.
with spam just in case. Yeah.
Go on.
I was just going to say, I foresee our Walmarts becoming a little bit more like Kinko's. You know, we'll have maybe our Fabbers at home that will be able to produce a lot of the goods that we need, but it might not be as big or as nice as the one at our regional Walmart Kinko's producer, you know, and we go there to buy things that are produced in greater resolution, perhaps, or you know, it's, you know, it just might be you know, easier to go out and get a bunch of things at one time rather than sitting there and waiting for it to be turned out on your home fabber.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. They'll probably be more like Kinko's, and they'll probably also be more like specialty high-end shops. If you can imagine, that's the direction Walmart is going, and then what currently exists as high-end shops would be even higher end, right? So the because the basics would all be stuff we'd be churning out for ourselves at home, assuming that we had the, you know, size of the fab and the interest in doing that. You know, I don't know, would we spin out our own toilet paper, or would we go pick it up? I mean, these are issues that we'll have to, address when we come to that technology. But it will look remarkably different from what we see today. But it's interesting to me that the the fact that desktop publishing didn't kill books says to me that replicators won't kill retail in the way that necessarily in the way that we had feared. I think that, that something else will happen on the value chain. Something will happen along the lines of this ability for people to specialize and individuate what it is that they're getting. And as long as retailers are able to provide that niche to meet that need, then that will go on.
You know,
this is Fast Forward Radio on the blog. Oh, sorry, Stephen. Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about setting the agenda for the future. And if you'd like to join us, we've got a live chat going on. If you're listening to us live, or leave your comments at blog.speculist.com. Sorry about that, Stephen. Go ahead.
I just wanted to throw in a couple more examples. Television has not killed the movie theaters yet, but you know, one a counterexample is the arcade. I think home video games have pretty much shut down arcades. There are exceptions to that, but you don't see them quite as much as you did, say, back in the 80s and 90s.
And in the meantime, created a much bigger market. I mean, you know, the video game market is bigger than all of Hollywood's entertainment output combined.
Wow. It's huge, isn't it?
Huge.
That's amazing. Quite a change, too.
Yeah.
Arcades do still exist. You have things like Dave & Buster's on the adult side, right? So adults go and play the games, and you know, as long as there's a liquor license, they'll go play games. And then there's, like, these kid places, right? These, like, mega family fun centers that have some video games in addition to all the skee ball and stuff you do to win tickets, right?
But
the thing that, like, guys like us grew up in, you know, where you could go hang out in an arcade and it would just be nothing but video game machines, it seems like that model has maybe been replaced.
Have you guys gone to a U-Wink yet?
No, we don't even know I don't even know what that is. I won't speak for Steve.
It's a small U, capital W-I-N-K, is a chain of restaurants created by Nolan Bushnell, who was the creator of both Atari and Chuck E. Cheese. And he somehow took Atari and Chuck E. Cheese and put them together as a family-friendly series of restaurants. We've got a couple here in Los Angeles now, and I know his son Brent, so that's actually how I know about them. Where you go to the table and it has a full touch, a full interactive touch screen. You not only order your own food exactly the way you like it, without ever having to talk to your waitstaff, but then you can play games, either among your own table, table to table, through the whole restaurant. It's like it turns the entire dining experience into an arcade experience. And I have to admit, I think it's a brilliant idea for some people, but I get a headache after about 5 minutes. But it's fascinating that he was able to take exactly what you were talking about, going out to be able to hang out. So instead of hanging out and just playing games, now you're paying for drinks, you're buying fries, you're sitting there having your nachos, and you're in essence having that interactive experience.
But the big rat is not there.
The big what?
Rat.
Chuck E. Cheese rat.
Oh, no, there is no rat. No, there is
no big
rat.
No rat walking around. Okay.
No, thank God.
Yeah, because one of the things I have to say is my wife and I are expecting a baby in April, and I'm looking so forward to all the wonderful things associated with raising a child, everything associated with raising a child, with one possible exception being the Chuck E. Cheese birthday parties. I have no fondness thinking back on any time I've ever spent in a Chuck E. Cheese. So
yeah,
but,
I have to,
but
say, I have to say the worst experiences I've ever had. I agree. Go on.
I mean, it is to shudder, and the food and the noise and the big rat, for crying out loud.
Bill's over there setting a big trap, you know.
Not a fan of the Chuck E. Cheese. I don't know if that came through. But what you're saying, this is not, I mean, he started that. This isn't like that. I mean.
No, there's no big rat. God knows. It would be bad for the food image. But, what I think is interesting is that it's taken the desire to have this kind of arcade experience and moved it to the next level. It's unbelievably high tech. I mean, it's very impressive. If you ever get a chance to go into one of these places, it's kind of a hoot. In terms of the amount of information that's actually coming to you and then leaving you from how what you want, from everything you want to eat to how you want to be entertained. I don't know if it actually can remember your previous choices. I mean, it's just it's amazing.
Cool. Even places like Buffalo Wild Wings, you know, and things like that. I mean, are pretty much. I mean, you're sitting there. You can play poker while you. Well, you video poker while you eat on the monitors all around you and everything. It's kind of interesting.
Well, that's true. Actually, come to think of it, any sports bar will have a trivia game, right, at the bar.
Right.
The more I think about it, maybe every place is an arcade now, come to think of it. That's actually the
arcade has disappeared into the background.
Yeah, the board collective has got us with the arcade stuff. And it sounds like some places more overtly arcade than others with the U-Wink. I don't think we have one of those in the Denver area. Michael, have you heard anything about a U-Wink anywhere around here?
There's three locations. They're all in California. And the new franchises are going into Florida and someplace else in the East Coast. And we'll probably get one, my guess would be never.
Yeah. Well,
probably 10 years before I get one.
If you gentlemen ever come out to visit me, I'll be happy to take you.
All right. That's the date, BJ. You're taking us to U-Wink next time we're on California. So, okay, so let's move quickly on. What are we, two items into our list? And then
yeah, we're never going to make it. We're never going to make it.
My goodness, we're not doing great on being tasky with the list, but I think we're having a great conversation here. Let's talk about new energy technologies. And Michael, since we've had you chiming in and since this is kind of your area, what do you see as like the top, give us the top two or three major emerging energy technologies that are going to revolutionize the world? Give us the top two, actually.
I'll give you two, and I will tell you that I have a newfound respect for the simple solution or the small technology that takes over the world. I was in D.C. this past weekend, and for anybody who goes to D.C., and I think actually if you go to the National Botanic Garden website, they have a section there too, although I haven't seen it yet. In their front yard, and believe me when I tell you the National Botanic Garden front yard looks way better than yours, they have a wind generator that looks like, well, it looks like a very large pencil. It's probably the one they have up probably is something between 12 and 15 feet tall and no bigger around than, oh, I don't know, a basketball and a half.
Huh.
And it's spinning as the wind blows. It will spin with any direction of wind, and because of the way the blades are designed, it will actually spin slightly faster than the wind speed, which I thought was kind of mind-blowing, but the thing that's cool about it is connected to best technology today to harness wind power, it will provide roughly one-fourth of the power to power the average American household. Now, me being me, I went and looked it up, and I said, oh, so for the rest of the world, not counting Western Europe, it'll power like three houses. Estimated expense to install and build the thing. At scale, and by scale, they were the guys who built the model were estimating a 10% market penetration in the U.S. Estimated cost to install at that point is about $1,500.
So, what does the world look like when we've got this these wind generators? I mean, they're just it's going to be just a our cities will be a forest to these things, right? They'll be everywhere.
I think every backyard would have one.
Uh huh. Would have one, not like six or seven of them, no.
Well, storage, of course, ends up being the problem because if you get two, you don't generate twice as much power. What ends up happening is you generate about 50% more power during the windiest times, but then you have the storage challenge. How do you store that? So with that technology, I looked at it, and I'm like, yeah, I mean, I would get one today if it was available and if I wasn't afraid that Colorado's net metering law was about to go away.
Okay, well, let's not go there. And then it gets inside baseball if we get to Colorado here.
That's right. And the other thing I would throw out, which is more tangential than actual energy advancement, is that both Mercedes-Benz or Daimler-Benz and BMW have now committed – to have a production vehicle, productional EV, electric vehicle, this year. BMW is going to do the Mini, which used to be Cooper, but it's not part of BMW. They're going to have an electric Mini, actually PJ, available in your neighborhood later this year. They're going to build a small number this in 2009, some of which are built, the rest are being built as we speak, that will be on the market this summer. And they're going to use that initial run as the sort of the soft launch for their full production. Daimler is going to use the smart car. If you haven't seen a smart car, I know they're in L.A. There's, I think, two registered in the Denver metro area. Daimler is going to use the smart car for their electric car. And the folks at Daimler think that by this time next year, so 13 months from now, 12 months from now, they will have somewhere between 30 and 50,000 cars in operation in Europe, and they'll be prepared to launch in the U.S. And the fact that they've both committed to an EV and the fact that they're both ready to have something that will be basically priced the same as its gas counterpart and have it this year, I thought was huge.
That is big. Very big.
Chrysler's going to have five,
yeah.
But they're not going to have their first one until the middle of next year.
Yeah. Everybody's making hybrids, and you know, it's just a matter of, if not this year, then the next year or two.
Electric vehicle technology, I think, is a huge leap forward for us. I think it's a big thing to do. But strictly speaking, that's not an energy technology.
That's right.
Something to do with the energy once we already have it. So you're banking on wind to give us enough power that we can run our cars off the electricity, or was there another?
I actually think the biggest deal with all energy technology today, whether it's the mythical but awesome blacklight or Bussard's design for a fusion reactor or anything else, is storage. We can do solar, we can do wind. There's some really cool wave generators out there, and geothermal that, you know, even in countries where they have really, really ready access to geothermal, it doesn't turn out to be cost-effective compared to your average barrel of oil because of storage. And the fact that two major car manufacturers are ready to go into production with something that will push the storage technology, I think, is big news. But you're right. In truth, it's not a energy technology. It's a ancillary to energy technology, but a very necessary one. Better batteries mean we can make a transition here that we can't currently make.
Right.
Well, I think it's a great point that that EVs will drive battery technology. That we'll need better and better and better battery technology in order to make electric vehicles work. And of course, the better our storage technology, the better we can make use of all these different ways of generating energy. Okay. Well, that's a fun one. Anyone else have anything to add on that one? I know, Michael, we're making you do double duty. But any comments from the chat room on that? Energy or any of the other topics we've had at this point. We didn't mean to leave our chatters out.
Don't believe so.
Okay. Stephen, you got an energy idea for us?
I think, Michael, you covered it pretty well. I think the Broussard model for fusion could be a dark horse that sneaks up on us, and if that turned out to be for real, then that could change everything.
I would add to the list, when we had Brian Wong on the program, not the most recent time, but before that when we were on when we were at the UN-conference, he was talking about small nuclear, talking about the new small implementations of nuclear fusion power that looks like it has the potential to really kick in and take off and provide us a lot more energy. It doesn't solve the storage problem, but just in terms of powering the grid in the first place to get the power into the cars, it's a big one. PJ, any thoughts on energy technologies?
I got a message from PJ in the back channel, Phil, that she had to run and she did not want to interrupt Michael. And so, at any rate, she wished us well and had to scoot. So,
well, we certainly thank her for being part of our program this evening, and we'll look forward to having her on again sometime soon. Okay, well, that then I think raises the point that this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and we're wrapping up our discussion of the setting the agenda for the future. Maybe we'll pick this up again in another program and talk about how we prioritize these, or we might take these a little further. But if you're listening live, you can join us in our online chat, or you can leave a comment at blog.speculus.com. Okay, so
hey, Michael, I'm sorry, Phil. Michael, you mentioned in the chat. I see you're mentioning the backyard sealed nuclear reactor. Do you think that's going to be important?
Yeah, I think. Well, and that's the one that Brian Wong was talking about a few weeks back. That I think is legitimately, you could say, in pre-production right now.
Right.
The company that licensed that technology from Los Alamos is funded. They're basically doping out the final marketing plan, which, as you might imagine, a fission reactor that you're going to plant in your backyard is going to take a carefully marketed message. I know I don't want to be the first one to put one in, and I don't want any of my neighbors to do it either. But they're at that stage. They're trying to figure out how to sell the deal. And I think what's going to end up happening is they're going to sell that deal outside the U.S. first. And once people start to feel comfortable with, hey, there's a nuke reactor buried under my driveway, then we're going to see that in more applications.
Well, obviously, when you say buried under my driveway, these things would power how many thousands of homes, Phil?
If we're talking about the – I can't think of the company's name that we've talked about a couple times before. Yeah, it was something in the order of like 200 homes for 10 years or 2,000 homes for a year or something. I mean, I guess those two would be the same thing. But, yeah, something like that. You get a cluster of these together, and you can run a subdivision on them. Is kind
right.
of the idea. You wouldn't need one for one house. That's for sure.
Right. Right.
And you know what's interesting, Michael? When you take that back to the idea of energy storage, these kind of no moving part nuclear power plants they're almost like big batteries. You know, they're not stored energy. They actually are generators, but in a sense, they're kind of like big batteries.
They in a very powerful sense. They're incredibly capable batteries, and the energy that's stored is partly what we put into it and mostly what we harvest or mine somewhere else. And if you think about that for a minute, you go, oh, so, you know, it is not renewable. It's not like solar or wind. No, it's not. But it is powerful, and only part of that storage capacity comes from us putting it together correctly and starting the reaction. The rest comes from the an enriched uranium that we basically harvest and do some processing on, but it's already here in limited quantity.
Yep.
Exactly.
I'd also add that Amory Lovins at the Rocky Mountain Institute has at least publicly for the last year, and I think not so publicly for several years before that, been claiming that dispersed energy generation like you would get with a small sealed nuclear reactor, or like you would get with a wind generator, like the National Botanic Garden is displaying, is the wave of the future. And that, yes, all the other things that are going on are going to contribute, and the grid probably should be smarter, but that at the end of the day, the grid will be, not if not irrelevant, a lot less critical than people care at present. Because we'll have energy generated at the point of use, or very close to the point of use.
You know, our next topic, technologies to clean up the environment, we've been hitting that all night, really.
Yep.
When we're talking about wind, solar, dispersed nuclear power like that, even clean coal, which we haven't mentioned, and, of course, electric cars and things like that, and even the VAT, V-A-T, meat that I mentioned earlier. Once we adopt these technologies, these are all things that will clean up the environment and reduce our carbon footprint and our footprint in many other ways.
Well, Matt, they will clean up the environment to the extent that the environment cleans itself up after we stop damaging it.
Right.
But there's another stage to cleaning up the environment, which is actually taking steps to reverse damage that's already been done. And I got it. I don't know how I got on this mailing list. It is not something I probably would have knowingly subscribed to, but and it's on my work email, so I don't have access to it right here. But I got this press release from a group called Ecological Internet, and they were talking about this group, the Alfred Wegener Institute, who is doing an iron seeding the ocean experiment. They're trying to grow algae in the ocean for purposes of seeing how much carbon that would sequester. Now these folks on Ecological Internet were just appalled by the whole thing, and they cited numerous international regulations that they thought it was in violation of, and they said you can't engineer a biosphere, and that you know that this distracts people from the real task, which is to stop emitting carbon. And you know, I mean, it was a very political piece, and it was very 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 negative on the idea. Of course, this idea, Stephen, is one we've written about before. One we got a lot of dig traffic once on, I think, right? We had a bunch of people show up and tell us that we were insane for wanting to try to re-engineer the world and all that kind of stuff. But actually, the idea behind using technology to repair damage that human technology has caused seems sensible to me. I look at that and I go, these same people who will tell me to go plant a tree or go plant 50 trees, you know, have a heart attack when somebody says, oh, okay, well, we're going to go plant algae in the ocean, you know, but what exactly is the big difference here? I mean, you know, it's like we're all about being green, unless the green is algae in the ocean. To me, the political response is just almost kind of puzzling. I guess people, once you get polarized, you can't see any value in what people are doing on the inside. And of course, you have to be careful about unintended consequences and what the risks of that would be. But I've never heard anyone say, hey, plant a tree, but be careful because of the unintended consequences of going out and planting all those trees, right? And yet these folks who are doing something, it seems to me very similar to that. There's this very very negative kind of political reaction to it. But I thought that it's a great idea, and to me it suggests the kinds of things that we might do in the future, not just to sequester carbon back out of the atmosphere, but also eventually it seems to me that we would want to do large-scale projects or even small-scale projects that grow to restore the fisheries. There's been talk about how those have been considerably depleted. It seems to me that there's probably going to have to be some kind of large geoengineering approach to getting all the plastic out of the ocean. You've heard about these like reefs of plastic bottles and bits of plastic that'll never decompose that are out there in the ocean. They actually present a fairly sizable risk to the creatures that live there. So I'm looking for technology that not only, you know, stops causing damage, but that takes that next step. What do you think, Stephen? Is that crazy and irresponsible, or is that something we should think about doing?
I think that in the environmentalist movement, to a great extent, is sort of a Luddite type. It's still holding Luddite type ideas close to the vest on that. With technology comes a cleaning up of the environment. Nobody really gets a charge out of destroying the environment.
Right. Unless you're like insane. Yeah.
I mean, everybody enjoys breathing clean air, drinking clean water, and seeing nature at its best. You know, nobody gets a charge out of the opposite. So, provided we have the ability to do things, and that's what technology does, is it gives us the ability to do things that we can't do now. Provided we have the ability to do things, we'll do them better, and we'll be a better steward of the planet. The other option, I suppose, is to go back to just relinquish technology, let half the world starve, and I suppose the planet could recover that way. But I don't see that as humane or a likely outcome. So I think technology is where we should put our hope in that.
Yeah, I think so too. I think we've got a lot of work to do around cleaning up the environment. And to some extent, ultimately, I think we'll have the capability to do geoengineering at a level that we currently. It will be as mundane as like landscaping our yards, right? I mean, obviously we're a long way from having that level of capability and understanding of what we're doing, but at some point that's what it will be. It will be bringing an aesthetic and natural beauty back to something, or even an artificially somewhat imposed beauty using natural elements. But it's that's probably a long way off. I have one final comment to Michael in the chat room. The question is define clean. Well, I think when the robots take over, hopefully their definition of clean will not be let's get rid of all this organic infestation, right? That's the thing we absolutely have to avoid. Okay, well, I think we got about halfway through the list, so maybe we'll pick this up on Sunday. What do you say, Stephen?
That sounds great. Sunday night at 9 o'clock.
Yeah, we'll be back at the usual time on Sunday. And why don't you tell us about our music for this evening?
All right. Everybody will recognize the song we're going to play tonight, Paul McCartney tune, Maybe I'm Amazed. And this is a cover done by Blake Morgan, who's not an unknown guy. He's been around for a long time.
All right. Blake Morgan with the classic standard, Maybe I'm Amazed, following up on our anthem of, hey, let's all be amazed. For those who don't know what that means, go to speculus.com and read up on why we should all be amazed. Well, thank you, Steve. We look forward to listening to that. Michael, thanks for your contributions. Once again, thank you to PJ Manny, our good friend, and to everyone in the chat room and everyone listening. We look forward to being with you again very soon, this coming Sunday, on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it.